Imagine a hospice counselor just sitting quietly beside a bed,
Right.
and he is just watching someone take their final breaths. I mean, you would think that at the very edge of life, with the clock running out, a person's final moments would be filled with, I do not know, reflection or maybe
Or at
peace.
least just letting go of petty grievances, you know?
Exactly. But instead, this counselor notices something that is honestly terrifying. He sees this profound, pervasive anger.
It is really striking.
It is. People right at the literal finish line of their lives are just incredibly deeply mad.
It is a haunting observation. It really is. And it forces you to ask, well, what exactly are we so angry about? What is the root of this modern fury that just follows us all the way to the grave?
And that is the central mystery we are taking an in-depth look at today. So the counselor who made that observation is a pastor. His name is Brother Steve.
Right, from New Life Family Worship.
Correct. And on the morning of September 6, 2026, he stepped up to the pulpit. Now, he was actually in the middle of this massive 80-week teaching series on the Sermon on the Mount.
Which is a huge commitment.
A massive curriculum.
Right.
But he looked out at his congregation, he thought about those hospice beds, and he just completely threw out his planned message.
He just pivoted entirely because he felt this urgent need to address the anger he was seeing. And not just in the dying, but in the living folks right in front of him.
So he delivered this raw, highly personal message, and he titled it The Lies of Satan.
And, you know, it is really important to state right up front how we are approaching this material with you today.
Right, absolutely.
We are acting strictly as your guides here. We are not here to endorse a particular religious worldview or, you know, preach a sermon to you.
Not at all. Our mission is just to impartially analyze the fascinating psychological and sociological framework he lays out.
Because Pastor Steve argues that our anger and our anxiety and all that exhaustion are the direct results of destructive narratives.
There it is, which he terms lies.
Exactly. Lies that infiltrate our daily lives. And whether you come from a religious background or a completely secular one, the mechanics of how these cultural illusions operate, how they manipulate human behavior, it is incredibly relevant to anyone just trying to navigate today's world.
Because before you can fix the anger, you have to understand the mechanism that is actually feeding it.
Right.
And Steve E's framework for how humans deceive themselves, how they hold on to pain and build these fortresses of resentment, it offers a brilliant lens through which to view our own modern struggles.
It really does.
And what I found so fascinating is how he actually begins this heavy, urgent message. Because he does not start with fire and brimstone.
No, he starts with humor.
He does. He tells a couple of light, almost corny jokes to the room. He is intentionally disarming his audience.
Well, he has to, because he's about to hand them a very difficult pill to swallow regarding personal accountability.
It is a masterful rhetorical pivot. I mean, getting the audience laughing so their defenses drop. And then he introduces the core premise.
And he anchors this opening with a quote from a comedian, Mark Lowry. Now, most of you have probably heard the old cliche, love the sinner, hate the sin.
Oh, sure.
It is one of those phrases that gets used so often to justify intense judgment while kind of hiding behind a mask of compassion.
But Lowry flips the script in a way that completely changes the target. The punchline is, how about you hate your own sin? Hating my sin is a full-time job.
That inversion is so crucial. It is the foundation for everything that follows in the message.
Before Steve allows his audience to look outward at, say, societal decay or political outrage or spiritual warfare, he forces them to look inward.
The mandate is very clear. Your primary jurisdiction for moral outrage is your own behavior. You cannot accurately assess the flaws of the world if you are blind to your own.
I mean, think about it like trying to clean a house. It is incredibly easy to point out the dust on your neighbor's window,
Right.
all while completely ignoring the giant pile of mud you just tracked onto your own living room carpet.
That is a great analogy.
Skidden is effectively saying you have to clean your own carpet before you start diagnosing the neighborhood's windows.
And that is a perfect way to conceptualize the psychology at play here. It is fundamentally about cognitive bias.
Right.
We are so incredibly lenient with our own mistakes. We chalk them up to difficult circumstances, but we attribute the mistakes of others to their fundamental character flaws.
Exactly. So once Steele establishes that mirror of personal accountability, he moves into diagnosing the external narratives.
He starts identifying these specific lies fed to us by society. He attributes them to spiritual opposition, sure, but they operate through very clear, observable psychological channels.
So let us get into the first of these illusions. He points to the ancient story of Adam and Eve in Genesis 3.
Right.
And instead of just treating it as ancient history, he frames it as an archetype for this lie that, quote, God is holding out on you.
Steve argues that the desire for more, you know, more prestige, more hidden knowledge, more status is a deliberate distraction from the good that is already sitting right in front of you.
Hmm. And what he's critiquing there is the scarcity mindset, which is basically the engine of modern consumerism.
It absolutely is. It is the belief that your current baseline is somehow insufficient and that true contentment is always just over the horizon, being guarded by some authority figure.
I mean, think about the mechanics of the Adam and Eve narrative. They are literally standing in a paradise of perfect good. They are surrounded by abundance.
But they trade all of it away because a narrative is introduced that convinces them there is this secret level of knowledge they are being denied.
It is essentially the fear of missing out, operating at a cosmic scale.
It really is.
Which transitions seamlessly into his next point, the illusion of self-sufficiency. He references Psalm 20, verse 7, which talks about some trusting in chariots and some in horses.
Basically, placing your ultimate faith in human engineering, military might, and personal power.
Right. And he contrasts this ancient warning directly with modern hustle culture. He actually specifically targets Nike's famous slogan, "Just do it."
Because "just do it" is arguably the defining mantra of modern Western achievement.
Oh, absolutely.
It suggests that sheer willpower, relentless effort, and just grinding it out are the only variables that dictate your reality. But Steve frames this as a very dangerous, exhausting deception.
But wait, I want to push back on this for a second, because I think a lot of you listening might feel some friction here.
Sure, it is a tough concept.
Isn't Steve's critique directly attacking the entire foundation of Western individualism?
Yeah.
I mean, from the time we are kids, we are taught that self-reliance, financial ambition, and pulling yourself up by your bootstraps are the ultimate virtues.
Yes, that is the standard script.
So to tell an ambitious person you cannot just do it yourself, it almost feels like an insult to our cultural sensibilities.
It absolutely rubs against the grain of the self-made myth. We revere the individual who conquers the world alone, but Steve is looking at the psychological toll of that worldview.
Okay, the toll it takes on a person.
Exactly. He is arguing that absolute self-reliance is not true freedom. It is a crushing, isolating burden. Think about the logic of it. If you are entirely 100% responsible for your successes, then you are equally 100% responsible for your inevitable failures.
You become your own god, essentially, which means you have to carry the weight of a god.
Precisely. And human beings do not possess the neurological or emotional hardware to carry the weight of total control over their destinies.
It is too much.
When you try to shoulder the unpredictability of the entire universe on your own back, it ultimately leads to profound spiritual and emotional burnout.
And we see that burnout manifests most clearly in the pursuit of wealth, which is another lie he dismantles in the message.
Right, the financial piece.
He uses this fascinating piece of local slang from where he grew up in South Tucson. The word is fidia, which means money.
Fidia, right.
He warns that chasing possessions is a trap because the goalpost is rigged to always move. As he puts it very plainly, it's never enough.
And in psychology, this mechanism is called the hedonic treadmill.
Right, we have touched on this before.
When you acquire something new, like a raise, a new car, a bigger house, your brain releases a spike of dopamine. You feel a surge of happiness.
But humans are highly adaptable creatures.
Exactly. Within a surprisingly short amount of time, your brain's baseline simply resets. That new salary is no longer thrilling. It is just your new normal.
So you immediately need the next acquisition just to feel that same high.
Steve is pointing out that building your core identity on the acquisition of fidia is a mathematical guarantee of permanent dissatisfaction.
So if relentless self-reliance is a crushing burden and the pursuit of wealth is a rigged game, what happens when the illusion of control shatters completely?
When the system fails.
Right. What happens when real tragedy strikes? And this brings us to what is, without a doubt, the most sobering point in his entire message, the stark reality of suffering.
He systematically dismantles the false promise of a pain-free life. There is this very common misconception, often perpetuated by certain modern religious movements, that if you just follow the right rules, pray the right way, and have enough faith, your life will be smooth, prosperous, and entirely shielded from disaster.
And Steve rejects that entirely. He cites the biblical figure of Job, who lost everything despite being righteous, and he points to the ultimate suffering of Jesus himself.
But the theology is not what gives his argument its gravity here.
No. What gives it weight is a devastating personal detail he shares with the room. He mentions, almost casually but with this heartbreaking weight, that his own mother died on a Monday and his daughter died on the very next day, a Tuesday.
Let us just pause and sit with the reality of that for a moment.
It is astonishing.
To experience the loss of your mother and your daughter within 24 hours, I mean, the statistical brutality of that is just unimaginable.
The cognitive dissonance of standing in a pulpit, claiming that God is sovereign, while carrying the fresh grief of a Monday and Tuesday tragedy, it is immense.
And by sharing that, he removes any possibility of the audience thinking he is speaking from some ivory tower of abstract theology.
Right. He's not giving them theory.
Not at all. He is preaching from the deepest trench of human grief.
He uses his own shattered heart to validate his premise.
Yeah.
Faith does not insulate you from suffering. Being a good person does not create some magical force field against tragedy.
And from that place of profound grief, he introduces a fascinating concept regarding how suffering functions within a group. He calls it posers versus possessors.
He argues that persecution, tragedy, and severe trials actually purify a community.
Which is an incredible way to look at it.
So how does that actually work mechanically? Why does suffering purify?
Because shared trauma forces authenticity. When a community is comfortable and wealthy, it attracts superficial participants, the posers, because there is a social benefit to being there.
It is easy to show up when things are good.
Exactly. But when the pain arrives, when there is a very real cost to standing together, the superficial members flee. The friction of suffering burns away the pretense, leaving only those who truly possess resilience and genuine commitment.
It is a stark contrast to modern prosperity preaching, which basically says comfort is the goal. Steve is offering a theology of resilience.
He references the book of James, which instructs believers to count it all joy when facing various trials.
He is asserting that suffering should not just be expected, but that it is the very mechanism, the forge, really,
yeah,
through which ultimate growth and character are created.
But, you know, we have spent time discussing the illusion of control, the treadmill of wealth, and the inevitability of abstract tragedy.
Right.
Often the most profound suffering a human can endure does not come from random chaotic events. It comes from the deliberate malicious harm caused by other human beings.
And that brings us to the emotional climax of the sermon and the final lie he confronts, the culture belief that you can't forgive.
This is where Steve's psychological insight truly shines, because, again, it is born from severe interpersonal trauma.
He reveals to his congregation a deeply traumatic backstory. When he was just 4 and 5 years old, he was sexually abused by his oldest brother, Raymond.
It is a horrific violation of trust.
He described waking up every single morning with hatred for his brother being the very first thought in his brain.
And you can trace how that trauma initiated a massive decades-long downward spiral.
Because he could not process the hatred, he began self-medicating with drugs at the age of 12. He spent years dealing drugs on the south side of Tucson.
The trajectory of unresolved trauma is so clearly mapped in his story. The anger becomes too loud, so you try to chemically silence it.
He eventually joined the Air Force, which actually forced him to stop using illicit drugs due to the strict environment.
But the underlying pain, that raging internal fire, was still there. So, like many trauma survivors do, he simply transferred his dependency. He shifted to alcohol.
He drank heavily until the decisive breaking moment at Cannon Air Force Base in Clovis, New Mexico.
Right.
He was caught driving recklessly, lost his base driving privileges, and was subjected to immense public shame within his unit.
That moment of total humiliation was the bottoming out, and it led him to a 30-day rehab facility.
And it was in that facility, finally stripped of his coping mechanisms, that he found his faith and began the agonizing process of truly forgiving his brother.
He even wrote Raymond a letter of forgiveness, a letter that, to his knowledge, was never acknowledged or answered.
Which brings us to a really fascinating nuance in how Pastor Steve defines the actual mechanics of true forgiveness.
This is the part that completely shifted my perspective.
And notice he explicitly compares the process of forgiveness to the principles found in Alcoholics Anonymous. It is a process that comes with absolutely no strings attached.
That is a vital distinction to make, because our culture usually treats forgiveness as a transaction.
Yes, we think, I will forgive you if you show me sufficient remorse, if you apologize, and if you change your behavior.
But Steve shatters that transactional expectation. He lays out very practical rules for forgiveness. And the first rule is that forgiveness is entirely for the victim, not the offender.
He uses the phrase seed of bitterness. If you harbor unforgiveness, that seed takes root in your own mind and grows into what he calls a stronghold.
If we translate stronghold into cognitive behavioral terms, he is talking about deeply grooved neural pathways.
Right.
When you rehearse your anger, when you replay the betrayal over and over, you are literally wiring your brain to default to a state of stress and hostility. The bitterness becomes a physical structure in your mind.
You are the one drinking the poison, expecting the other person to die.
Exactly.
By demanding remorse from your abuser before you grant forgiveness, you are handing the person who harmed you the keys to your own emotional prison. You give them ongoing daily power over your peace.
That is exactly the trap. Forgiveness, in Steve's framework, is the unilateral severing of that emotional chain. You require zero action from them in return.
But, and this is where his second practical rule becomes so important, forgiveness does not mean releasing the offender from consequences in the real world.
This is such a crucial clarification. So many people refuse to forgive because they think it means saying, what you did was okay.
Right. Forgiving someone internally does not mean shielding them from the legal or social ramifications of their actions.
Not at all.
You can unilaterally forgive someone in your heart, severing that emotional chain while still sitting on a witness stand and testifying against them in a courtroom.
The internal release of hatred does not negate the necessity of external justice. It is about separating your emotional survival from the administration of justice.
And his third rule might be the most liberating piece of advice for anyone trapped in a toxic family dynamic. He states unequivocally that forgiveness does not require reestablishing a relationship.
I found this deeply profound, especially coming from a pulpit.
In many religious or family structures, the pressure to reconcile and pretend everything is fine is immense.
It is overwhelming for a lot of people.
But he acknowledges a dark truth. Some family members live to offend. If a person is truly evil or continually destructive, his advice is remarkably practical. He says forgive them, pray for them from a distance, and keep away from them.
It is a profound boundary. He validates the reality that evil exists in the world and that protecting yourself from ongoing harm is not a failure of forgiveness.
You can offer someone total, unconditional spiritual forgiveness while maintaining absolute physical and emotional distance.
It is an incredibly sophisticated and protective psychological framework. It allows you to heal without offering yourself up for further abuse.
We have covered an immense amount of ground today, and I want to slowly recap the narrative through line of Pastor Steve's message.
It is a lot to take in.
He started by forcing us to look in the mirror, to calibrate our own flawed lenses before we judge the world. From there, he dismantled the deeply ingrained cultural narratives that drive our anxiety.
Starting with that scarcity mindset that tells us we never have enough, and the crushing illusion that we must control everything ourselves through sheer hustle.
He confronted the false promise that living righteously or working hard shields you from tragedy.
Right. By sharing his own immense back-to-back grief, he proved that pain is a guarantee, but that shared suffering is also the forge for genuine resilience.
And finally, he dismantled the ultimate poison, which is held grudges. He demonstrated through his own severe childhood trauma and his subsequent battle with addiction that true forgiveness is an internal mechanism of survival.
It is a unilateral action, entirely disconnected from the behavior or the remorse of the person who harmed you.
Regardless of where you stand on matters of faith, the architecture of these arguments holds immense value.
The principles of radical self-accountability, accepting the reality of suffering, and unilaterally releasing bitterness are universal tools.
They really are. They're the exact tools required to navigate a world that feels increasingly angry and out of control.
Absolutely.
As we bring today's analysis to a close, I want to leave you with a new angle to ponder. It builds directly on this idea of the mental stronghold.
The deeply grooved pathways we discussed.
Right. Pastor Steve talked about how harboring unforgiveness creates a fortress of bitterness in your mind. I want you to consider this. Completely outside of any theological context, think about your daily baseline of energy. How much of your daily anxiety, your chronic exhaustion, your mental fog is actually just the tremendous caloric energy required to perform the mental maintenance on your own grudges?
Because resentment is not passive.
Exactly. It takes active, constant energy to keep that anger alive, to rehearse the arguments in the shower, to replay the betrayals.
That drains
you. What would happen to your energy, to your mind, to your life, if you stop demanding an apology that is never going to come and you simply drop them?
That is a fascinating question to sit with.
Thank you for joining us in the room today for this in-depth look. Until next time, take care.